good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth, the program where captivating people talk about their unique jobs. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I'll be chatting with Amir Abushama, a biomedical scientist for a local pharmaceutical company. Amir is also the outreach leader at Islamic Foundation North in Libertyville. He collaborates with various interfaith and civic organizations in Lake County while educating folks about Islam. And Amir, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jim, for having me.
You know, I had the opportunity to attend a prayer service at Islamic Foundation North a few weeks ago. Wonderful experience, by the way. Everybody was so friendly, so welcoming. And it was interesting. The message that I heard that day in the mosque seemed to echo doctrines that I have heard in sermons in Christian churches, in temples. And I think it's kind of the same message, and I don't want to simplify it too much, but what I was hearing that day anyway was be humble, be kind, work together, care for each other. You know, I do imagine there's a little bit more to it than that, and I think that's what we're going to talk about in our conversation today. And maybe we should begin by talking about the origin of Islam. And I guess the core of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, I always call them the big three, seem to link their history to Abraham. And the root of Islam traces its roots to Ishmael, Abraham's son. And I was just wondering, what role did Ishmael play in the start of Islam?
Yeah, good question. So actually, so Abraham had two sons, as we all know. Mm-hmm. Ishmael was the older son, and he had Isaac. And we know that from the Isaac's branch, the eventually Moses and Jesus came along. From the branch of Ishmael, Prophet Muhammad came. And basically, the thing to remember, though, from the Islamic perspective, is that Islam, although it was finalized with the presence of Prophet Muhammad, and Abraham, of course, had a kickstart to it, mm-hmm. it really started from day one, from the creation of Adam. So as Muslims, we believe that Islam, really, the core message of Islam, which is the belief in the one and only God, follow his guidance so that you may attain success in this life and the hereafter, really came from the creation of Adam, but it became finalized or formalized the way we have it today with the coming of Prophet Muhammad, who was a descendant of Ishmael.
Well, let's talk about Muhammad then. He's the key, and you call him the prophet, too.
Yes, right.
And I guess what I'd like to look at a little bit about his background. Tell me a little bit about his past.
Sure. I'll try to make it brief because can talk for a long time. So Prophet Muhammad actually was born in 570 AD, and he received his first revelation at around the age of 40 at 610 AD. He passed away 23 years later, which would make it at 632 AD, at the age of 62 or 63. And mm-hmm. we do know that growing up, he was an orphan at a very young age. So he lost his father before birth. He lost his mother at the age of 6, his grandfather at the age of 8. He was known for his humble and noble and exemplary character even before he received revelation from God. Mm-hmm. He was actually nicknamed as the honest and the trustworthy individual, and people knew him for that, for those characteristics. He was known to be a shepherd, and at some point he actually went out on what we may call business trips or had interactions in business dealings, and people saw his performance in that setting and his character. It was not until the age of 40 when he received his first revelation. Now, he lived in a primarily pagan society, the Arab society that he grew up in Mecca, which would be Mecca today in Saudi Arabia.
He was born in Mecca, too.
He was born in Mecca. Mm-hmm. And it was mostly a pagan society. There were some Christians, probably more Jews at that time, but for the most part, a pagan society. And he had a lot of issues that he didn't agree with, saw the ills in the society that were spreading. There were some good characteristics, but also a lot of negative or bad characteristics. So he used to seclude himself on some occasions. He would just basically go by himself and just stay quietly in a certain location in a cave. And on one of those nights, which is believed to be the end of towards the last third of the month of Ramadan, which is the most holy month in Islam, the Islamic calendar, he received his first revelation from God through Gabriel. Mm-hmm. And that's when really the revelations of the Quran began, and until he passed away 23 or so years later.
Is that when he learned about Allah?
Actually,
that's where when did Allah come about?
Yeah, so Allah is actually, so let me clarify something.
Because Judaism is
Yahweh.
Christianity, God.
Right. It's the same.
And then Islam, Allah.
It's the same thing.
Okay.
So, and there, I know there's a lot of, this is an excellent question because there's a lot of confusion about that.
Yes.
So the word Allah, it's really basically the Arabic word that means the one and only God. That's all it is. It's a very precise form of the word. It's only used for God. It's not used for anything else. No one ever calls themselves that or claims that at all. It is the word for God from day one. In fact, if you look at, even if you talk to Christians in Arabic-speaking countries, they do use the word Allah. In fact, before coming here, I looked at one of the Bibles I have at home, and in the beginning they have a, you know, like a verse translate from the Bible translated in different languages. And in the Arabic text, they use the word Allah.
Oh, they do?
So okay. It's actually you. It's not a new word. It's not something that Prophet Muhammad, you know, coined or came up with or... but it's very precise. It's unlike in the English language, you know, like when we write God, G-O-D,
yes,
we could make it plural, we could make it feminine, we could make it feminine plural, we can have all these combinations, but Allah in Arabic is the one and only God. It has no, there's no question about it. It's just, you're talking about a specific, the creator, basically.
Now, you said at age 40, that's when he started to dictate the Quran?
That's when he received revelation.
Or
yes.
The revelation.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, from Gabriel.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
And then that became the Quran.
Right. I guess I forgot to mention an important thing too, is that he received revelation. It wasn't his own doing. And there's a lot of detail to that. We can talk about it for a longer time, but he was actually illiterate. And that's an important thing that I forgot to mention.
Right,
he never
right. That's
went
why
to school.
There was no writings, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. He lived in, one of the challenges in his society was the excellence and the beauty of the Arabic language, the eloquence. People were so eloquent and they used poetry and songs and they played around with the grammar, and that's really why the Quran is the Prophet Muhammad's biggest miracle, in that for someone who's illiterate to receive revelation, people knew this was something beyond human means, and there are a lot of different miracles or aspects of the Quran that we can obviously get into, but so yes, but the Quran was revealed to him it wasn't in a lump sum, it was like piece by piece, depending on even in different situations.
And is that what the five pillars are then?
No, we'll get
okay.
to that.
Yeah, that's okay, the same, okay, yeah. I'm way ahead of the game here.
Yes,
okay, go
okay,
ahead
yeah.
then, yeah.
So yeah, so it was actually revealed over a 23-year period in different pieces.
Oh,
and yeah, and it
okay.
was recited, you know, memorized on the spot, recorded on the spot, so it was documented already, and then after he passed away, it was put together in the book that we have today.
Okay.
Which has not been changed for 1,400 years. It's the same identical Arabic language, the language of the revelation.
Okay, so the five pillars are basically the thesis of the Quran?
Well, no, not quite. So, yeah, so that's another bigger question. So let me back up a little bit, because I think there's some confusion sometimes between the pillars and the articles of faith.
Okay,
so,
let's distinguish between the two.
Yes,
and tell us about the pillars.
Yes, so first of all, in order to understand what a Muslim believes, we need to understand what are called the articles of faith. I mean, sometimes they are called the pillars of faith. But those are six articles, and I'll walk you through them very quickly.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
And then we'll talk about the five pillars, because there are five pillars of practice or of Islamic practice.
Okay.
And those are a separate thing. They go along hand in hand, but they're different things.
Hmm.
So when you look at the faith itself, what does a Muslim believe? I mean, I know a lot of people who are listening probably are aware of Muslims praying. They may have seen that in a documentary, or they know about the month of Ramadan, the month of fasting. They probably saw a documentary about the pilgrimage or the Hajj. But when we talk about the articles of faith, we're talking about what does Islam really stand for?
Sure.
Based on the Quran, and that's really where it comes from. So the six articles, first of all, and the most important one, is the belief in one God, that God is one, he's indivisible, he's not one part of anything, he's not, you know, divided into different parts, or he's one, only one, and he doesn't resemble any of his creation, because he said it in the Quran himself. He said that he does not resemble any of his creation, meaning that he can't, so in Islam, he can't be a father, he can't be a son, he can't be a husband, he can't be... he has no competing power or associate, not even Satan. He created Satan. He's the creator of the entire universe, basically. So
there isn't a Holy Spirit in...
No.
Right. Okay,
so I think, so that's where we can go off on another tangent.
Okay. But, we'll stick with the articles
yes,
of faith.
But
okay.
just a quick side to address your question. So the Holy Spirit, so I mean, the interpretation of that in the Islamic perspective could simply mean Gabriel, who is an angel.
Okay.
So
okay.
that brings us to the second article of faith.
Okay.
So the first article is God, the belief in one God. Mm-hmm. And God has many attributes or adjectives that describe him, you know, like he's the most powerful, the most loving, the most just, the most merciful. And there's so many of these things that help us understand who he is. First, that's the first one. The second one is the belief in angels. So Gabriel being one of the most notable examples, the angel of revelation. The third article of faith is the belief in prophets and messengers. And we believe that there were so many of them. In fact, they could be in the thousands as far as we know.
Hmm.
But there are 25 mentioned by name exactly, precisely in the Quran, beginning with Adam and they're ending with Prophet Muhammad, including Jesus, Moses, Noah, and many of the ones we're all aware of, peace be upon all of them. So they all came with, to convey the same core message over and over to humanity. Now, some of them were messengers. They came with books as well, which we call holy books or scriptures, and that's really the fourth article of faith. And so there are probably a few books that we are aware of, but most notably were the Torah to Moses, the Gospel or the Injil, which is the Arabic word, to Jesus, and then the Quran to Muhammad. And again, these were all messages or revelations from God.
Now, listening to this, it sounds like the Bible is the core. And then the Quran came from that. Am I on the right wavelength or not?
Well, it's not exactly like. So to clarify, and that's an important question, actually. So as a Muslim, I must believe in the prior scriptures, meaning the Gospel or I guess the Bible, if you want, we call it that.
The Torah.
Or the Torah. Mm-hmm. But we believe in the original revealed form, which would be the Word of God. So the issue for us as Muslims is that if we had the original revealed form put side by side with the Quran, there would be 100% alignment. I'm pretty confident. But the issue is that we have different versions. We have different, you know, things were modified or changed or translated in different ways. And so, but when we say the Quran is the only book, the book we use, it's the only book that has not been changed in 1400 years. And God actually says in it that this is the final message that is to be, that's revealed to, given to mankind, basically. So everyone gets the same message. And that this book will be preserved until the end of time. And it's preserved in so many ways. And there's so many intricate details and aspects of it that really bring this picture home. But, you know, one of the things is just the recitation. Like we talk, the Quran itself, the Arabic translation of it, it is the recitation, or it's actually recited and memorized by millions around the world. Just to let you know, Jim.
Not the entire Quran.
The entire Quran, yes, exactly.
Well, I picked that book up. It's quite heavy.
Well, you can have different. You can have a pocket size if you so it comes in different font sizes. but that's a good point.
Wow.
No, but it is actually, in fact, here in our community in Lake County, at our Islamic Center or mosque, minutes away from here, we have at least about maybe 9 or 10, close to a dozen teenagers who have memorized it by heart, cover to cover. The youngest is a 10-year-old. It's amazing.
Jeez.
It's very impressive. And we're talking 114 chapters.
Yes. The chapters themselves, they start off very short, but they get longer and longer and longer.
It depends on where, So you bring up an interesting point. So if you're starting from the English way, from left to right, if you're reading left to right.
That's how I did.
Yes, that's normally what a lot of people do, even like kids when they learn the
Quran. I just read a few of the short chapters, by the way.
That's what I would have done too.
Okay.
So yes, you're right. So from the left side, which is the end, chapter 114 going backward, these are the usually shorter chapters.
Yes.
They could be like just three or four verses.
Right.
They're pretty short. And then you go, but if you start from the beginning, from the Arabic side, the right to left, you have one short one in the beginning, only 7 verses, which we recite in prayer all the time, every day. But then you have the longer ones. So you have one of the longest, about 286 verses in it, and so on.
And then you say that you have a 10-year-old who's memorized all this.
Yes.
It's extraordinary.
Yes. And he reviewed it multiple times too. So this is one of the ways by which it is preserved. The Arabs, I guess, to understand that, we got to back up and look at the context of Prophet Muhammad's lifetime growing up and the society he was in. Like I said, the Arabs had this excellence in, or eloquence in, language and poetry and song and prose and grammar. And they were also an oral culture. They relied not on necessarily everything written, but they would hear something and they would recite it to each other. They would sing it to each other. They would actually memorize things quite easily. And that's really one of the challenges. That's the miracle of it, that it's actually preserved through memorization. And you will notice it in prayer. Like if someone is, if you're attending, for example, a prayer that's heard out loud, like when you were there at the Friday service about a week ago, if someone makes a mistake in one letter, you will always find someone behind you to correct you, because someone knows every part of it. And that's really one of the beauties of it. So,
What's the overriding message of the Quran then? If we're going to talk a little bit about that now.
Yeah.
And it is the five pillars. Is that correct?
Well, no, actually, so we were trying to get there, but I don't think we got quite there. So
I don't mean to push you forward.
No, sure.
That's not my point. I'm just trying to make sense of it. But go ahead.
Yeah. No, so let's just to wrap it up. So I think we talked about four, the articles of faith.
Articles of faith, right.
So there's a fifth and a sixth. The fifth is the belief in the day of judgment and the afterlife. And then the sixth one is the belief in divine decree or destiny. So those are the articles of faith.
So if you're Islamic, you do believe in the afterlife.
Absolutely, yes. That is, in fact, the crux of why we're here and that the purpose of life, actually. That's okay. What it's all about. So to put it all in a nutshell, Islam basically, in very simple terms, what we do know that God is that God created us for a reason. And he tells us in the Quran that he created us to worship him. And worship means a lot of things. It means belief, these articles of faith we talked about. It means the pillars, which, I know we haven't gotten there, but it's basically the prayer and the fasting and almsgiving and doing pilgrimage and having, obviously you have to have the foundation.
Well, let's not rush through those.
Yeah.
We should spend some time on that.
Sure.
Because that's the, I think, right. I want to understand the Quran
yes.
a little bit more. So
right.
let's talk about these five pillars.
Okay.
Because that yeah. seems to be, to me, the core of Islam. I know the articles of faith, you've gone through those.
That's the foundation, yeah.
But right. When I think of Islam, the average person on the street thinks of the Quran.
Yes.
Okay, so what are these five pillars?
Yeah, so the five pillars are, so assuming someone is a believer, understands the articles and comprehends them, is sincere and committed to them.
Which is a lot of information.
Yeah, someone really has to know what they're
invest
doing.
Invest a lot of time, yeah.
Right. It's actually, well, it really has to do with guidance. I mean, ultimately, God is the one who gives guidance. So we talk about the six articles, but it's not as complicated as it seems. It's just basically comprehending that or understanding or declaring that God exists.
Mm-hmm.
We have a creator, and then he put us here for a reason, and we'll get to that, I know, shortly. But once someone comprehends that and accepts it, becomes a Muslim by definition. In order to become a Muslim, actually, the basic thing you do is you basically have the declaration of faith. You're basically saying that I believe in that there's only one God, none but him, that who deserves worship, and that the Prophet Muhammad was the last prophet and messenger. And that's it. That's, by definition, a person is a Muslim at that point. And that's actually the first pillar of the five,
okay.
which is called the testimony of faith or the mm-hmm. creed or the declaration. I mean, it's called different things, but it's really the same. And then there are four other pillars. So the second one is praying five times a day. The third is almsgiving.
Praying five times a day?
Yes.
Are they specific times that you pray?
Yes, absolutely. The idea here is that prayer is actually the most important of all the pillars in the sense that that's really the direct bond between us and God. In Islam, there's no clergy system. There's no intermediary. So it's all between us. It's an open door policy. You know, it's between you and God all the time. But God, you know, among his many countless blessings, which we're never going to, you know, repay him ever for, he asked us to do a few things, and one of those is really, and the one of the most important ones is the prayer at specific times throughout the day as a reminder. So because we go on with our life and we get, you know, wound up, we have work, we have kids, we have, you know, whatever we do, we go shopping, we live our life as, you know, we all do, but then we get carried away and we forget, and so it's a time to bring us back and put things in perspective. So those are five times, and they're spread out during the day. Ideally, you pray them on time during that time window. There's a range. It's not like, you know, a split second, and if you miss it, you're in trouble. You have a range of time within which you can pray it.
And then how long, the length of the prayer?
Yeah. And
15 minutes, something like that? Or
it might be even less. So it really depends. I mean, so depending on what you want to recite, you have there are some parts that are fixed in the prayer. Actually, most of it is fixed in the format.
Mm-hmm.
But like you heard in the Friday prayer, for example, there is, after you recite the opening chapter or the first chapter of the Quran, there's a second part you recite. It could be a chapter, it could be a short one, it could be a long one, it could be a few verses. So there's a difference in length sometimes, but every prayer varies, maybe just in the units. So the first prayer is the shortest, the one at dawn.
It's, should we listen to a little bit of that? Would that be helpful?
Sure.
Yeah. الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Sounds beautiful.
Yes, I mean, so that is actually the chapter one from the Arabic, from the right side.
Okay.
And that is the one chapter that is actually required in every unit of prayer that we pray. That's really the basic, the bare minimum or the basic chapter that one needs to eventually memorize as a Muslim.
Wow.
And as you can see, the Quran has, I know a lot of people who don't know it might think they're listening to a song or poetry, but
It sounds like a song or poetry. Right,
yes,
right,
yeah,
right.
A lot of rhymes. But mm-hmm. it's actually Word of God, and it there's a lot of profound meanings in all the verses that we read.
So when we were listening to that, what was the message?
So, and I'm trying to give it in a nutshell without having it.
Yeah, I don't mean to simplify.
Yeah. So the message is really pretty simple. I mean, the overarching message, I'm assuming that's what you're referring to in Islam. So God created us to worship. And worship means to have the right belief, but also to couple that with the actions. We have to have actions to support our belief. And action or worship doesn't simply mean the five pillars, like the obviously prayer or fasting are definitely requirements, important things. But
yeah, we haven't talked about the fasting part of it yet.
We haven't even got But it's also important to know that worship really means it's all encompassing. It's a complete, comprehensive way of life. It's how you and I interact with one another. How I deal with my wife, how she deals with me, how I take care of my kids, which are really a trust from God. It's about how I treat my neighbor kindly, how I am generous and kind and forgiving to my parents, especially as they get older. It's all these things put together. That's really what we're here for. So God created us. He put us on earth for this reason. He gave us guidance. He didn't just leave us aimless without any, we make up our own rules all the time. But the fact is he gave us guidance. And assuming we find that right guidance and follow it, then we will attain success, not only in this life we're living in, but in the hereafter. And that's where we have one of two outcomes. And I know maybe I didn't elaborate on that before, but it's either eternal paradise or there's eternal hell. And those are the two options. And that is really the eternal life. So this life, from the Islamic perspective, is really no more than a test. We're living here a very short life, no matter how long we live. It's very limited, and we have to do the best we can, because this is the period of testing we have.
Mm-hmm.
And just to add to that, a lot of times people struggle with some of the problems that happen in this world. Like, there's often this complaint where people get sad when there's a hurricane or a tornado or war or disease. But these are all just tools and means. God knows where we're going to die, when and how. We don't know these things. He knows the unseen. But the reality is this life is short. That's really the perspective we got to have, that we got to focus. Keep our eyes on the ball, I guess, if I may.
Eyes on the prize.
Which is the hereafter. Mm-hmm. That's really what we need to focus on.
Now, the fasting's an interesting part of it. And I guess my question would be, why?
Right. So fasting...
Christianity, we're not... well, go ahead.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So to clarify, so there is a verse in the Quran that actually says that fasting was nothing really... It's not... In essence, it wasn't something new to Muslims. It was actually prescribed upon people before us, other people of the book, like the Christians and the Jews. I mean, they have some form of fasting.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And, whether it's followed or not or how it's done, I mean, that's another story. But
Muslims, it's much more strict.
There are some requirements. Mm-hmm. And I know how, for example, some of my Christian friends fast, how they do it. In Islam, there's a certain regimented way of doing it. So it's 1 month in the year. And just to back up a second, the Islamic calendar is also 12 months, just like the Gregorian calendar that we live by.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lunar calendar, so the months are 29 or 30 days. So it's the whole year is 11 days shorter, so every year it shifts. It's going to move up a little bit. So what we're instructed to do in one of the pillars of Islam, one of the five, is to fast 1 month in the year. It's 29 or 30 days. So we're fasting from dawn till sunset, and that means no food and, believe it or not, no water, because I know sometimes people don't realize that. It's really
I did not know.
Yeah, no food, no water. For those who are married, like a husband and a wife, they have to avoid any physical relationships or intimate relationships or interactions. And the idea really is that God is giving us preventing us or having us not do certain things that are normally allowed. They're not forbidden. But he's training us. He's given us a course of training. Every year we get trained. It's like a workshop or a course of discipline, or like boot camp for 1 month.
Sure.
Where you come out after it as a better person. And in addition to that, the month of Ramadan has a lot of significance. Like in one of the last 10 nights, it's believed that that's when the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad initially. And usually in the evenings after we break fast, there's after the fifth prayer of the day, we have extra prayers in the evening together as a community. We come together. A lot of times the whole Quran is recited in prayer during the month. So that's another way to polish up on your Quran memorization. Mm-hmm, and any action in the month is really multiplied, several fold over what you would do outside of them. So it's
very disciplined.
Yes, very much so.
So let's just finish with the other pillars before we take a break. I don't mean to rush you, but we've talked about prayer, fasting, and
almsgiving. So alms, I guess sometimes people call it charity, but really what it is that if I have some wealth beyond my daily needs, my necessities, mm-hmm. beyond what I need to, you know, pay for in terms of food and drink and maybe gas and school supplies and all these things that I do in everyday life, if I have some extra wealth saved, let's say it's sitting there, I had it for at least a year, I need to give a percentage of that. And it's not really a whole lot when you think about it. It's a minimum is 2.5%. That's really what God is all he's asking us to do.
Unlike in the Old Testament, tithe.
Right,
or 10%.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Well, there are some categories like which are more detailed where there is the 10% rule. But for most of us, for you and I or most people out there, it's 2.5%. So if I saved, let's say, $10,000 in the bank, I've had them for a year, they're sitting there, don't need to use them, or maybe they're growing, I would pay 2.5%, which is what, like $250 out of 10,000, which is not a whole lot. Now, of course, if you do more, that's even better. But again, if so, the other thing to point out is that if someone doesn't have the wealth, then they're not going to be judged negatively because they didn't do it. Because if you don't have it, you don't have it. So it's provided that someone has to have it, and it goes to certain categories of people defined in the Quran. You know, those who are needy, or maybe you know they have a clear legitimate need for that type of support. So it's a way to establish social justice among society. I may be well off today. Someone else may be poor, you know, doing worse today. Tomorrow, the whole situation may reverse. It goes back to the belief, the Islamic concept of what Islam is, declaring there's one God who created us. Everything goes back to him ultimately. Not just, you know, obviously we do, but also our wealth comes from him and it will go back to him.
Now, the two other that you have then?
Yeah, so we talked about the declaration of faith. That's the foundation.
Right.
Prayer being the most important.
Right.
Alms, fasting. So there's one more, actually, the pilgrimage.
You know what? Maybe we should, when we come back, because I don't want to just rush that.
Sure.
When we come back, let's talk about the pilgrimage.
Okay.
And there's really much more to talk about. As a matter of fact, when we do return, we're going to talk to Amir about social norms and his observations and thoughts about Jesus and the New Testament. We're talking to Amir Abishama, the outreach leader at Islamic Foundation North in Libertyville, and you're listening to Word of Mouth. Back after this. And you're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich, and we are chatting with Amir Abishama, the outreach leader at Islamic Foundation North in Libertyville. In the background, you heard the music of Cat Stevens, who changed his name in 1977 to Yosef when he converted to Islam, and since then has been devoting himself to humanitarian and Muslim causes. In fact, he received the Man for Peace Award, Cat Stevens. Amir, we were before the break talking about the five pillars, and I didn't want to rush about the last one, and that was the pilgrimage. You want to review the four before that, and then we'll get into the pilgrimage. And then I do want to talk about, you know, some social norms with Islam and also about the role of Jesus in Islam. But let's get to the finish up with the pillars then.
Sure. Thank you, Jim. No,
yeah.
That sounds perfect. So so basically, just to review the first four pillars we talked about the declaration of faith, you know, when someone accepts the message of Islam. And basically acknowledging that there's one God, only one God, and that Prophet Muhammad was the last prophet and messenger. Second pillar was the prayer, which is actually a daily, there are five daily prayers. We talked about almsgiving, which is to be done. It can be done all the time, but at least on an annual basis, you give a certain percentage of your wealth, extra wealth, to those who are more needy. We talked about fasting, the month of Ramadan, which is, again, on an annual basis, it's done 1 month in the year, 29 or 30 days on a lunar calendar. And then finally, the pilgrimage, which is done once in a lifetime. And the pilgrimage really has a lot. That's a whole topic in itself. We probably could spend, you know, hours. My wife and I were fortunate to make the trip about a couple of years ago in 2011. It was a wonderful experience. There's a lot of different things we can talk about. But just in brief, it's the fifth pillar of Islam. And we need to do it once in a lifetime as Muslims for those of us who are financially and physically capable. So the trip does require quite a bit of patience. You're there among millions of other pilgrims.
Literally, millions.
Yes. In fact, in 2011, I heard numbers of somewhere between 3.6 and even someone said like up to 5 million. So the numbers are pretty large. It's very crowded. But the beauty of it is you see humanity there in the same spot, doing the same acts of worship, mostly commemorating Abraham's struggles in his lifetime as a prophet, as one of the greatest prophets. And Everyone does the same things, but they all come from different parts of the world. They come from different cultures, different backgrounds, different colors. And it's really, there's a lot of things we can learn from that experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, we also talked about a tiny bit. We touched on Jesus in the first mm-hmm. segment. And you started to kind of allude to your impressions of Jesus. Mm-hmm. How do Muslims, the Islamic faith, mm-hmm. how do they view Jesus?
Yeah, it's in Islam, it's quite simple. Jesus was one of the greatest prophets and messengers that ever lived on earth.
So comparable to Muhammad.
Absolutely, yes. Yes. In fact, like I think I mentioned early on, that we believe one of the articles of faith, I think that's the third one we talked about, is that we believe in prophets and messengers, beginning with Adam, ending with Muhammad, and it includes Jesus, Moses, and many of the other ones, peace be upon all of them. And so there's 25 of them mentioned by name in the Quran. Jesus is one of them. But we do not believe that he's God or son of God.
Okay.
We believe that he was a prophet and messenger. We don't distinguish.
But you do believe in the afterlife.
Absolutely, yes.
And in a sense, the resurrection.
Yes, absolutely. Hmm. Yeah. But
That's curious to me.
Right. In what way? So please clarify.
Well, the resurrection, that's basically the philosophy of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And
actually, from the Islamic perspective, that's the way it is from day one.
Okay.
In fact, since God created Adam, he placed him on earth as the first human being, Adam mm-hmm. and Eve. They started humanity. And Adam was given the task of prophethood first, as the first one. And it was the same core message we believe from day one. Mm-hmm. It was to believe in God as the one and only God, follow his guidance so that you may attain the success or in this life and eventually in the hereafter.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all know that we're, you know, life, like I said, life is short. It's a test. We're all going to die mm-hmm. at some point. We mm-hmm. just don't know where, when, and how. Mm-hmm. And when after death, we're going to go back to the soil to soil or dust to dust, we're going to come back on the day of judgment, be resurrected mm-hmm. for a one-on-one meeting God one-on-one. We're going to be accountable for our actions. Everyone is responsible for his or her sins on that day.
Okay. Okay.
So Jesus was really...
parables, like the walking on water and... How do you view the parables?
So,
and the stories.
I guess if you want to call them, so I would call them like miracles. I guess that's what you're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So we believe in many of the same miracles that most Christians are familiar with. So, mm-hmm. Jesus was able to heal the sick, was able to revive the dead. But God says in the Quran in multiple verses that when he did that, he did it with God's will. So God was the one who gave him that capability. These are some of the greatest miracles of Jesus. Now, one of the greatest miracle he ever had was that he was born without a father, because we do believe in Islam that he was born out of a virgin birth, Virgin Mary.
Mm.
And by the way, Mary is one of four women who are labeled or designated as the most, the best women in the entire humanity. They're the devout, pious. So Mary is among them. And there's a chapter in the Quran, chapter 19, titled Maryam, which is the Arabic form of Mary. And so Mary's well known, from an early age, and she has very high respect in the Islamic tradition. Jesus was born without a father, but Adam had no father or mother. So, when we want to compare them, we see, look at Adam, he came from the raw materials, he came from the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the other thing I should point out is that Jesus had many miracles. One of them that I think is not known to many, because it's specifically in the Quran, I have not heard it mentioned by anyone else who's not a Muslim. It's that in the Quran, God has... In chapter 19, again, if anyone flips to verses 30 to 35 there in that section,
mm-hmm.
It talks about how Jesus actually spoke in the cradle. So that was really his second miracle in his life, was that he spoke in the cradle to defend his mother and to explain who he was as a prophet of God, that God gave him scripture, and that God put him here on earth to guide people and to basically pray and ordered him to pray and to give charity,
mm-hmm.
and that he's blessed in this life, and even on the day he comes into this world, and the day he dies, and the day he's brought back again,
mm-hmm.
and that basically the fact that he is here on a specific task. He never said that based on the Quran, he did not say that he was God or the son of God, but he was a prophet of God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's really one of the things that stands out in the Quran that I'm not aware of any other source that has that. It's one of his many miracles, actually.
In terms of Jesus, what are your impressions of Christmas then?
Yeah, that's a good question. So,
because you seem to believe in just about everything, except he's not the Son of God, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering where is the line drawn there?
Right.
So, well, let's go with Christmas first of all.
Okay. So Christmas. So first of all, I guess I'll try to answer from the purely Islamic perspective,
sure.
from the sources. So we typically as Muslims do not really celebrate prophets' birthdays. In fact, even Prophet Muhammad's birthday, it's not. There's nothing that I'm aware of from the Islamic, you know, from the Quran or the Sunnah or the guidance of Prophet Muhammad that says you have to celebrate his birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Because birthdays are not really the key points for us.
Okay.
There are other take-home messages or other other key incidents or events that really that we relate to or that we may celebrate. We have two holidays, and we can talk about that when we get there. But so we don't. Now there may be some people around the world who commemorate the birth of Prophet Muhammad, but that's not really. There's no celebration, you know, dictated, or we're not instructed to do that. So the same would fall, happen with Jesus. We don't have that. We don't celebrate any of the prophets' birthdays in that sense. You know, if you ask me about my,
There wouldn't be a Christmas tree in your house then.
No. I mean, some Muslims, just to be, you know, give you
the whole.
Broad answer,
what about the? Yeah. Well, then you've got the whole Santa Claus thing going too.
Well, Santa Claus, we all know it's. I guess even kids know that today. I mean, they know it's. You know, it's a fictional character. Maybe it was based on some. You know, specific individual initially, but I think it's understood. I mean, there are some Muslims or some people who may, you know, want to celebrate for one reason or another. Maybe they have. Family that's not Muslim or they come from a Christian background. I mean, it could be for different reasons, but from the purely Islamic, purely from the Islamic tradition, we would not celebrate Christmas because that's not, we typically don't celebrate the birthdays of the prophets themselves. That's not the key thing. The other thing is, to be honest, you know, Jim, I'll tell you, very close to my house, about 5 minutes away, I think it sums it up very nicely. There's a church and next to it, there's a place where they're selling a lot of Christmas trees. And they have this big sign that comes out every November, December, and says, "Put back the Christ in Christmas." So my observation over the years, that it has become more of a commercial
marketing
issue. You know, people are scrambling to buy gifts a month ahead of time and looking for sales and deals and Black Friday and all these types of things. But, you know, as Muslims, you know, when you go to the sources, what we're instructed to do is to stick to those holidays that have a real religious significance that impacts our life.
Mm-hmm.
And we really need to bring back the perspective into what we're celebrating and how we're doing it. And I mean, some of the, obviously in Christmas, there are a lot of good things about, you know, getting together with family, you know, eating together or, you know, inviting others, buying gifts and these things.
Community.
We do things like that in our holidays too. But these things should happen all year round. And we should always be reaching out to our parents and taking care of them and taking care of our kids and, you know, being nice to one another. I mean, that should be like something that we do every day.
Well, let's segue to the holidays. We talked about Ramadan.
Yes.
And you were going to mention two others.
Right. So let me, point of clarification. So Ramadan actually itself is not a holiday.
When I said it, I was
sorry
I said it.
Yes. No, but it's maybe if I can clarify, that would be great because I think there is some confusion over that. So Ramadan is the most special month because of the Quran was revealed in it.
Right.
There's a month of fasting, but it's not really a holiday per se. I mean, I think a lot of people think, they tell me this too. I mean, I've had it happen a lot. Oh, Ramadan, you have your holiday coming up, but it's not really a holiday in itself. So we have two holidays. They're both called Eid. You spell them E-I-D I guess it's translated as feast or celebration or we just say holiday for the sake of clarity. One is called Eid al-Fitr and the other Eid al-Adha. So the first one is the feast or the holiday or the celebration of breaking the fast, which is really the day right after Ramadan is over.
Mm.
So that is when the holiday comes. It's the day you eat and, you know, you go back to...
Drink some water.
We have invitations. We go to prayer in the morning, kids, so we get them gifts. We do a lot of, you know, similar things that you may have in Christmas time.
Okay.
Meet friends and family and relatives.
Sure.
You eat together and every country or every culture has a different way of, you know, celebrating, but that's really the holiday after the end of Ramadan.
And that's called again?
Eid al-Fitr.
Okay.
And Fitr, it comes from really having breakfast or breaking the fast.
Okay.
So you're no longer fasting the mandatory fast of the month of Ramadan. And then the second one is about 2.5 months later, and that's really Eid al-Adha, the feast or the holiday or the celebration of sacrifice. And that's at the same time that the pilgrims are in Mecca doing their annual pilgrimage.
Okay.
So it's for those who are not there, you're celebrating here, and again, it's similar in a way, but it's sometimes it's called the bigger holiday because in a Muslim country there will be more days off. But it's basically more of the same things. You're praying together, you're meeting one another, you're connecting with one another, and just being in the same, in unison and harmony with and unity with those who are actually doing the pilgrimage, and it's a special time of the year as well.
I'd like to turn to social issues and social norms. And when I was at the prayer service, I guess it was a week ago Friday, I noticed that the women were worshiping upstairs and the men were worshiping downstairs. Now, for me, that was curious. And I have to ask, why is that?
Sure. Yeah, so this is just one format or one. The reason we have the women upstairs, like in the balcony level or second floor, and the men on the first floor, that's really just by design of the mosque, the way we had built it early on. But it can be in different ways. In some mosques, you're going to find them. You're going to find the women behind the men. In other mosques, you'll find them next to each other with some maybe a curtain or a partition in the middle. And the idea is...
So there's a separation. Yeah,
there is a separation,
so let's talk about the separation. Yeah. And why the separation?
Right. So the separation is because of the physical nature of the prayer. And if I don't know if you recall, when you observed the prayer last week, there are physical movements, you know, where you're actually kneeling, you're going or bowing halfway, you stand up, then you go down. And we actually prostrate on our forehead on the carpet or on, whether it's a carpet or a prayer rug or, you know, some surface, which is really humbling to God, that we're, you know, putting the most humble part of our body, being lowest, and just humbling ourselves to God. So when you do that, it could be a distraction for the man if he's praying behind the woman. And it may also make a woman feel uncomfortable because if a woman is, you know, prostrating in front of me, it would be distracting.
So that's the reason.
Yes, the idea is to keep everyone focused, because when you're praying, this is the most, and I don't know if I said this clearly, but this is the first thing we're going to be asked about on that day of judgment is, how was someone's prayer? It is the one pillar that no one is exempt from. You know, someone could be exempt from fasting if they can't fast. Maybe they have to take medicine regularly for some reason, or it could be they don't have any extra wealth. They don't have to do alms. They may not have the money or the health to do pilgrimage, but prayer, even if you can't do these motions, you really have to. It's something that everyone has to do. That's the bond between us and God. It's in like a connection. And so it's important to be focused. And that's really why, when it comes to men and women, there is a separation. Unless if it's women by themselves, for example, then one woman can lead and then the other women or sisters behind her would follow. And that's okay. They can pray anywhere.
Does that also segue then to the fact that they're covered from head to toe, and they're wearing the hijab?
The hijab, yes, absolutely. No, so that's definitely, I guess it's an alignment with that. So the hijab is actually instructed by God to give women a form of modesty. It's really done for modesty. It's important Islamically that a woman gets known for her intellect, for her mind, for you know, her character. It shouldn't. The first thing we see about a woman or a female shouldn't be her body, which we all know it has a great deal of attraction compared to a man's body. So the idea is that you really, the woman is covered, she can show hands, face and hands. Those are the two parts of the body. And the hijab can take different forms. And it's actually nothing new, Jim. I mean, it's actually something that's or has been in Christianity historically. If you look at the Catholic nuns, they do cover.
Right.
They do it all the time. If you look at the, for example, Orthodox Jewish women, and I see them sometimes on a Saturday morning, on a Sabbath, and they actually do cover. They have a different form, but it's also done. So it's nothing new. In fact, when I look at some
of
the...
It's not quite as dramatic, it seems.
It has different forms, and I think nuns are actually pretty pretty similar, but Islam really, like I said, it's a way of life, so it's you got to implement all these things in your everyday life. It's part of... There's no separation between the mosque and your... If you believe, you got to act on it. That's really... It's a comprehensive system. And by the way, the Muslim woman covers, if she does cover, not just in... not all the time. It's when she's in public. So if my wife is, you know, at home with me, and she doesn't have to cover. So there are certain rules. It's only when you're outside in public, or there's someone who can see you who could be eligible to marry. So it's a form of modesty and controlling
respect.
Gender relationships and respect in that time.
I am talking to Amir Abashama, the outreach leader at Islamic Foundation North in Libertyville. You're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich. More after this. And you're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich, and I'm talking to Amir Abashama, the outreach leader at Islamic Foundation North in Libertyville. And in the background, you hear Masoud Curtis. That's a music CD that you brought in. Thank you so much, Amir.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You know, we've talked so much about so many things about Islam, and one thing we do need to touch on, you're involved in building bridges and collaborating with various interfaith and civic organizations across Lake County. What types of things are you involved in?
Yeah, so we actually do quite a bit of different things. But, you know, I guess I can sum it up in three primary goals or three priorities. First of all, education, a lot like, you know, what we're doing here today, for example. And it's not just me. It's a group of us who are volunteers. We actually represent our mosque or Islamic Center. We talk about, educate about Islam and Muslims, and we do it in different ways. Either we have groups that come and visit us, and we host quite a few groups around the year. They come and maybe observe prayer. They may come for a tour of the mosque, and we give them whatever education, answer any questions they have. And we also go to folks as well. And we do this with high schools, with hospitals. We've done it. We're doing it on a regular basis with the Great Lakes Naval Base, for example. And so that's really the education part. But we also collaborate. We're trying to find opportunities where we, as people of faith, can come together with churches and synagogues and other groups, people of faith, to do activities that help social, you know, do social good in the, within Lake County. So, for example, PADS or homeless shelters, we get involved with that. We're members of Lake County United.
Just speak about that for 1 second. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so if we're trying to, for example, engage our younger generation, which sometimes can be a challenge, and try to have them come together, maybe make meals, set up beds, and we do this in collaboration. We do it actually at a church, and so, and hopefully someday we'll have it at our own location. And we try, it's just a way of giving back to the community that we live in. Other things I was going to just mention briefly, we, for example, adopted a highway, and that's another way to engage our youth, the younger generation in the community. And in addition to that, we do a lot of, we've been doing for a long time, interfaith dialogue, for example. We have events like that. We have maybe like a Ramadan iftar dinner that's held, for example, on an annual basis. And there's a Thanksgiving celebration that we may go to at one of the local hospitals. So it's a lot of different things, and there's always more to do, but it's all based on volunteer efforts, and that's really one of the challenges. The last thing is that we try to support any new Muslims. There are some people who come to Islam, they accept the faith, they come to it, you know, new to it, and they need support as well, and, you know, a source of guidance and feedback for them.
What's the most pressing problem you wish to see addressed? I guess if I had to ask it another way, what prayer would you like Allah to answer?
Yeah, so that's a tough one, because there are so many things. You know, God gave us so many, there are countless blessings. We are so blessed in many ways. And especially being in the United States, where we have this diversity and we have this interaction with all kinds of people and colors and races and religions. And so I think we have a lot of blessings. But there are also a lot of problems. There are a lot of, I think we covered some of them, have to do with the misconceptions about Islam and Muslims, which hopefully we're trying to do something to address. But I think, you know, in general, the thing I would ask God for, Allah, would be simply having a just peace around the world, for everywhere where there's conflict, even locally and abroad. And I will maybe wrap it up with one supplication or prayer that we use as Muslims. It's one of the most concise and the most to the point, and it's very encompassing. It's basically, we ask God to give us the best in this life that we're living in, and to give us the best in the hereafter, that we have the best outcome.
Amir Abishama, it has been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Really appreciate that. Now, if you wish to contact Amir and learn more about the Islamic Foundation North in Libertyville, go to the website outreach@ifnonline.com. And thank you for tuning in. I hope you'll drop by again next Thursday at 11 a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.